Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new and very special episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. My two co-hosts are not here today. So in order to make up for the loss, we had to find three people. And these are all men who went to the Sundance Film Festival. So this entire episode is going to be devoted to the flicks that are kicking up the most chatter out of Sundance this year. So let's go down the list. First of all, we have our esteemed, I was going to come up with some vaguely communistic sounding phrase, but I'm just going to kill that idea. Our esteemed editor-in-chief, Jordan Raup.
Hello.
Hello. We then have someone playing the maracas. What the fuck was that? Wait, let me guess. Dog scratching.
Yes.
All right.
That was the dog.
Brad, remember when you said you were going to use the mute function? That's the time when you do that.
All right, do we have to start over now?
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Next, we have Dan Mecca.
What's up?
Not much.
All right.
And then, last but certainly not least. Arguably not least, we got Rafi.
Hello.
Hello. So you guys were able to make it out to the Sundance Film Festival. You are our boots on the ground. And you're going to let the fine people at home know what some of the hits and misses were. Before we get into that, I'd just like to remind everyone to give us a comment and a rating on iTunes because we love it. You can also comment on this show on its page at thefilmstage.com. If you want to talk to us directly in the long form, you can send us an email at podcast@thefilmstage.com.
We love to hear from you guys.
Yes, we do. Even though you're not a regular on the show, I'm sure you
I still... like to hear from people, so I imagine you guys do too.
Right, you just extrapolate. It's like, Well, if I love hearing from people and his job
it's is all about the interaction. We need you guys to interact with us.
Hell yeah. Absolutely. Well stated. So there's no discussion this week because honestly, the discussion has kind of been monopolized by all the news coming out of the Sundance Film Festival. So we're going to give you the site's top 10, then we're going to talk about some other random stuff. Then we're going to talk about what's coming out next week, and then we're going to get out of your way. So let's just do this.
Let's do it.
Number one, Boyhood.
Dun, 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 dun.
Who wants to introduce this? I can do a little intro. Even though Dan wrote the review, you can read his eloquent review on the film stage. And you can also read our top 10 on the film stage for further thoughts. But Boyhood.
I was going to plug it at the end so people didn't just turn off the podcast.
We can just plug it every 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, so Boyhood, I think, was the one, at least I was anticipating the most, and I think Dan, maybe Raffi, aside from one Indonesian action flick, which we'll talk about later. But this was the one that, far and away, I think, is the best film of the festival. It did not play in the competition. It was a surprise premiere at the last minute, and for a little background, if you follow our site, you probably should know, because we've been discussing it for a while, but it is... Richard Linklater's Before Midnight follow-up, technically, although he's been making this one for 12 years and it's finally done, and it chronicles a boy who his name is Eller Coltrane is his real name, and Richard Linklater cast him, I think he was 6 years old, and the film chronicles his life from 6 to 18. They shot a few days every year, and this film is absolutely fantastic. It's pretty seamless in terms of the integration, and it's probably one of the most relatable films I've ever seen. Just in terms, I would say like 7 years apart from his growing up, but there's a lot of relatable stuff in this, and just the way Linklater, his relaxed approach, is like a perfect fit for this material. How you just kind of see this boy's life unfold. It hits all like the big major points, but there's also just moments where just maybe him and his dad talking that, like if you've seen the Before trilogy, you know how perfect Linklater is at just writing these great scenes. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't use the word masterpiece lightly, but this truly is a masterpiece. I mean, everything about this film, from just the seamless manner in which time flows to the way it makes you think about life's fleeting moments, it really has a profound effect as you're watching the film, making you think about your own childhood, or if you're a parent, making you think about your child. You know, I really enjoyed the Before series, but this is really hitting it out of the park, and I really connected with this movie. And I think unanimously at the festival, this was lauded as like the crowning achievement of the fest. I mean, there was really, to me at least, not a film came even close to touching it in terms of how profound and deep and moving and special. I mean, it really is like unlike any film you've seen.
Yeah, and also really funny, which is kind of surprising. People who think that this might be kind of like a Tree of Life-esque film, like, I don't know. I talked to some people before, thought it would be like this. Like,
isn't that the next film we're talking about, Jordan?
It is, a little bit. But this is, it's very much like, it's like a mix of the Linklater you've seen in Before and then also like a little bit of Days of Confused or Slacker. I mean, this could be a prequel to Slacker, kind of.
Definitely.
So, Dan,
it's a very special film.
Yeah, no, I mean, I totally agree. I think most people at the festival agreed. It's kind of so funny in a way that the last 2 years, Linklater has come in with the most impressive movies both years in a row.
He's dominated the festival the last year.
Yeah, I mean, last year, same kind of deal. You know, I don't think it was quite as last minute, but close to the festival, it was announced that Before Midnight was going to premiere, and then sure enough, it premiered. Everybody loved it. It wound up on a lot of top 10 lists by the end of 2013. And I really feel like Boyhood's going to be kind of more of the same. I mean, this is just not only an impressive feat of just filmmaking, right, because it's 12 years. You know, he shot essentially a week a year with the same actors for over a decade. And just to watch Patricia Arquette, who plays the mother, age, and Ethan Hawke, who plays the father, age. And then
he
more.
He doesn't really age, though, Ethan Hawke.
Well, yeah, no, Ethan Hawke has a mirror in his attic, apparently. But other than him, I mean, especially Eller Coltrane is just so impressive, almost just by virtue of him growing up. You know what I mean? And just, I don't know of anybody who couldn't watch this film and take a moment in their own life and relate it to something that's happening. And I just, I mean, it's just, there's not really much more to say. You got to see it for yourself. And I think it definitely won the festival for sure.
Yeah. And you will cry at random moments just out of.
Great.
I'm just letting you know ahead of time. And
I'm going to forge a correction. It is not a mirror that is in the attic. It is most likely a portrait.
A pig portrait, sorry. Portrait.
Someone took a pause on that. I wanted to be that
darn guy. Darn it. I apologize.
And I guess after each film, you should say when the listeners can see it. And this one is going to be out either May or June via IFC Films. So.
Excellent. All right, now let's move on to The Better Angels.
Yeah, so I mentioned Malick before, and this one is literally a Malick production, even though he did not direct it. This comes from his... he was a second unit director on New World and Tree of Life, and he edited To the Wonder. And his name is AJ Edwards, and he crafted this film not dissimilar to Boyhood, and just in the fact that it takes place in 3 years over a boy's life. But this boy is destined for great things. It is Abraham Lincoln, and it's just kind of his story. Like, if you've seen the middle chunk of Tree of Life, a lot of things are borrowed from that. But this is black and white, and I said in my review how I feel in the last few years, especially, there's been kind of a fever pitch of people comparing, you know, films to Malick. And yes, he did have a hand in this, but this is one of the first that actually feels like he's taking his voice. And I don't think he's doing anything new with it, but he's actually kind of reaching some of the heights of that Malick can reach, just in terms of the camera. If even though it wasn't shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, it feels exactly like he had his hand on it. The score is by Hannon Townshend, who did To the Wonder. There's voiceover. This one's actually from historical documents from Abraham Lincoln's cousin. Like 100% all the voiceover is historical, which is really interesting. Yeah, and so this was probably one of the more divisive films of the fest. I saw a few reviews which just said he was pretty much ripping off Malick and doing absolutely nothing.
It sounds like a carbon clone the way you describe it, but
I'm just wondering how they work in the whole "this is Abraham Lincoln" thing.
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
Because I feel like, you know, those little like books you would read when you were a kid, and it's like, you know, this young man like didn't have a mom and blah blah blah, and that he became.
They never say. It's actually interesting that you bring that up. They almost go to pains. They like painstakingly do not say his name. So at the beginning of the film, there's a little bit of narration, which I guess is presumably by the cousin of Abraham Lincoln. And he kind of talks about, you know, people ask, you know, about, you know, where he came from, blah, blah, blah. And then there are little historical moments within the film that are, you know, directly Abraham Lincoln mythology and whatnot. So it's one of those things. I guess, do they say that at the beginning, Jordan? Do they say they Abraham Lincoln?
There's two bookends, and the first bookend is they show the Lincoln Memorial.
That's so, what it is, right.
And then
that's
at the end, they show it, right. They film it at the actual cabin where his mom, his stepmom lived. So I don't know. But yeah, and then there's like, I mean, they see, you see him see slavery for the first time, which I asked the director, and that's actually not historical record. It's just a show kind of, you know, because this takes place in Indiana where there was a free state. But he just kind of inserts a few things. Like you see, I mean, the bulk of the movie is his relationship with his parents, which include his dad, and then, which is kind of like the relationship Hunter McCracken and Brad Pitt have in Tree of Life. He's like a very hard ass, and then his mom and his stepmom, who has a huge effect on his life, which his mom was played by Britt Marling and then his stepmom by Diane Kruger. Yeah. And so, I mean, if you like know the history, which I didn't know fully going in, but if you know the history, I mean, it's clear that they were very painstakingly like authentic with the actual history. So
yeah. I did not care for the film quite as much as Jordan did. I did like it. I am very curious what A.J. Edwards will direct next, but I do think it is a bit derivative of Terrence Malick and does lack enough of a singular voice to make it truly a great film. And, you know, even – and also, I mean, just in general, it'll be a tough film to like. I mean, not unlike To the Wonder. There's just so little narrative, and it's – I mean, so much of it is just visual and repetitive.
Glide cam shot after glide cam shot.
There's a lot. It's almost a little bit rougher in the way it's shot. You know what I mean? There's not, when you say glide cam, it almost feels more like steady cam to an extent. You know what I mean? Like a little bit rougher, but you know, I think the talent's there, and I hope that this guy can make another film, because he does seem to have, you know, kind of the makings of somebody who could definitely find his own voice. So,
all right. Excellent. Well, then, do we know when this is going to get?
Yeah, no distributor was picked up yet, but it's going to be at Berlin Film Fest, so maybe it'll get one there. We'll see. Yeah,
excellent. Next up, Land Ho.
Yes, I think I was the only one that saw
You're
this.
A Land Ho.
this is a film, this premiered in the next category, which is kind of like, you know, smaller budgety films that are kind of, yeah, anyways, and this is from Martha Stevens, who did Pilgrim Song, and Aaron Katz, who did Cold Weather. And it's a very small movie, but one of my favorites. It just follows two guys who are presumably in their 80s or in their 70s. They never say their age. But anyways, they go on a trip to Iceland. And it's I've compared it to like the trip to Iceland. That's what I said in my review. And it's kind of like that. They eat great food. It's actually a lot raunchier than the Trip series, and it's just a really funny, enjoyable, charming movie. Not a lot of conflict in it, which is kind of refreshing compared to a lot of Sundance films. And yeah, I mean, I don't really have to go too far into it, but it's just the one actor is Paul Einhorn, who kind of broke out, even though he's in his 70s. He broke out at Sundance last year with This Is Martin Bonner, which was won the next award. So yeah. Definitely see this when it comes out. Sony Pictures Classic picked it up for a 2014 release.
All right, excellent. Next up, Life Itself.
Yes, this was a film I think all three of us saw. This is the Roger Ebert documentary about Roger Ebert's life, directed by Steve James, who directed Hoop Dreams, which was a film that Roger Ebert championed during his career, if you're familiar with that, and actually like made the film rise to prominence to the point where I think it was nominated for an Oscar. And it's a look at the last kind of few months in Ebert's life. It was kind of an odd timing that they got together, like right as he was kind of slipping to the point of where, you know, right to the very end. And it kind of documents that part of his life, and then also examines like excerpts from his autobiography, so kind of going through his history. And I think for all of us, you know, who do film criticism or have enjoyed Ebert and Siskel and Ebert, the show, or read any of his reviews, can really appreciate his contribution to cinema and really appreciating it. And I thought this was a really heartfelt, really well done send off to the legend that is Roger Ebert. And I was really moved by the film. I mean, it's almost hard not to be, because it's so raw how you see him in his last months, and it's painful to watch, because you just see how fragile life is, and it's really sad. But at the same time, life affirming, because he lived a really full and happy life, and you can see that by the people who talk about him. So yeah, I really enjoy that.
And I thought it was actually interesting that they actually don't just, you know, paint his life with pretty colors, like how he suffered from alcoholism.
Yeah,
like they talk a lot about his alcoholism, and also they talk about how a lot of people think that he like hampered film criticism in terms of just being a thumbs up, thumbs down approach.
They kind of made it like fast food. They made it like mainstream and devalued like what film criticism was all about. So they don't like overly idolize him. They really show him for who he was, which I thought was really refreshing.
And you can see Martin Scorsese tear up, which I've never seen before. So
yep, and great excerpt from Werner as well. Werner Herzog. Yeah. I mean, it's just some great, really great interviews about people that knew him really well.
I did not actually get a chance to see the movie, so I cannot wait to see it when it comes out. What's the distribution for that?
If you contributed to Indiegogo, I think you have 2 weeks to watch it. And other than that, they haven't said how it's going to come out, but I assume it'll be in the next few months.
HBO or something like that. Right.
Definitely keep an eye out for that one.
Indeed.
If
you're what?
If you're a fan of Ebert, I was going to say. But I guess any
if you movie. Like movies. If you've seen
movies.
Yeah,
if you like movies. Yeah.
Next up is Listen Up, Philip.
Oh, yeah.
Listen Up, Philip.
Listen up. The next film from Alex Ross Perry. This is his third feature after The Color Wheel. And then
God.
Oh, yes, The Color Wheel. I forgot. Go back to the episode where Brian.
I haven't ripped it yet.
Brian, I think you might actually like this one better.
Well, it'd be really hard to
actually.
Like
this is actually really funny because Brian also hates Francis Ha, and the three people I compared that he nodded to in this movie were Woody Allen, Noah Baumbach, and John Cassavetes. So this is Brian's worst film of 2014 already, and I loved it. No.
I don't understand what it is about this genre that turns me off so much.
This one, yeah, I actually would be interested to see what you think. Anyways, it's about Jason Schwartzman's character, Philip, who he's on the verge of releasing his second book. And from the first scene, Brian, ready? This will let me know if you tell Aaron if you like it or not. From the first scene, he meets an ex-girlfriend of his and pretty much brags to her how he's releasing his book and how he never wants to see her again. And then he, a friend from high school who never went anywhere, or from college, never went anywhere, he meets him and just pretty much shits all over him and said he hasn't gone anywhere in his career. And then he... And then the end of the scene is you realize the guy was in a wheelchair and he wheels out of the restaurant. And so, yeah, it sets him up to be a massive asshole. But I found it kind of compelling in terms of the fact, like, how, you know, kind of this, like, very brittle creative type in New York City, just looking at his life and how, you know, on a whim he's very insecure and it's kind of an interesting structure. You follow him for like the first third, I would say, and then it kind of goes to you see his girlfriend who's living in New York City while he goes up to upstate New York to work as like a professor. And his girlfriend's played by Elizabeth Moss of Mad Men fame, sorry. and almost a breaking there's a Breaking Bad character in here too, Kristen Ritter. She plays Jonathan Pryce's daughter, who is upstate with him. And anyways, it's kind of this interesting look just about, you know, literary types and their thought process of things. And and even though he may be despicable, it's an interesting story. So
as a struggling author, I could either love this or hate this.
Yeah, I don't know.
Apparently there's a lot of really good literary references, right, Jordan?
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of like just... really instantly quotable lines. So it's like packed. It's pretty much wall to wall dialogue. If you also add in Eric Bogosian's narration. So, it definitely has all those things. And then the style is Cassavetes, but the writing is very much like Woody Allen or Bob Beck. So
I heard a lot of praise for this film from people I spoke with.
Yeah, it's good. Especially, and even if you didn't like Color Wheel, I mean, I like Color Wheel.
I was about to say,
love
everyone else loved the Color Wheel. So
I wouldn't know. Really compare it that strongly to this movie. It's definitely a big step up.
I mean, does it, in terms of the Clover World, does it have the same type of comedy though, or what's the?
I felt like the Color Wheel was just a little like meandering in terms of, like, it had more of a laid back approach with its dialogue, where this is very much like, you know, he's a very like forward thinking protagonist and like very like in your face kind of.
Right.
Okay.
Like he's not just people like, you know, talking about life. This is more like he has this singular vision for the world, and you're just seeing it. So it's right. Kind of like has more energy to it, I would say.
Okay. Does this have distribution?
No, not yet.
Oh, thank God. Coming up.
It's coming out, Brian Rowan Films. That's
I'm going to do that. I'm going to set up a shingle where I only release films that I actively dislike.
It's like The Hobbit. The
Hobbit. Oh, God. Yeah.
The Rowan Collection.
The Rowan Collection. If you hate Brian Rowan, you'll love these movies. Next up is Memphis.
Yo, what up?
Memphis?
So I saw this film towards the end of the festival. It is a very small film, about 80 minutes long, shot for nothing, starring this musician, this real-life musician named Willis Earl Beal, I believe. And essentially the whole film is about this artist who has the talent and has had some of the success required to, you know, become a world famous musician, and is essentially throwing it all away because he's slowly losing his grip on reality. So the whole film essentially follows him as he meanders through Memphis and burns all the bridges that he and his talent has built over the years. There's not a lot happening in terms, you know what I mean? I mean, in terms of just plot and, you know, traditional, it's a fair warning that, you know, this is a film, you know, though it's only 80 minutes long. I mean, we're with this one guy the whole time. And I mean, yeah, I mean, he'll sing, and when he sings, it's beautiful, but a lot of it is him just doing things that seem crazy because that is what is happening to him. So it is definitely, you know, the kind of film that will detract some people, but it's a fascinating, I mean, at least I felt it was a fascinating look at the artist's struggle. You know what I mean? You know, the idea that almost that Amadeus idea, you know what I mean? To be truly great at something requires a little bit of insanity. And what is that, you know, what's the price that you pay, I guess. And there's a nice line in the film where this Memphis local says to Willis, he says, you know, that talent is a gift from God, and you know, you got to pay that debt, right? And that's like the whole film, the idea, like, what is the debt you have to pay because of the talent that you've been given? And so, you know, the director is Tim Sutton, who he directed a film called Pavilion that premiered at South by Southwest a couple years ago. And, you know, it just has a really cool aesthetic, really cool look. It's like early Gus Van Sant, if I had to compare it to anything. So definitely give it a look. It got picked up by Sundance Channel, I believe. So it will be available probably more on the small screen. But definitely give it a look. The music's beautiful. And the cinematography is outstanding. So, you know, definitely keep that in the back of your minds.
Inside Lewin, Memphis.
kind of like that, yeah. Except, you know, a lot less dialogue.
All right, excellent. Next up, The One I Love.
To the one I love.
Was I the only one who saw this one?
Yes, sir.
Wow. All right, so here we go again.
Are we just not going to acknowledge
it's actually
the fact
gonna be three
that
in a
someone
row
just started singing?
Yeah.
That was pretty much our Sunday experience. We just broke it into song.
Yeah, we would just ignore Ravi when he starts singing.
Okay, I take it back. That would be the Sundanciest Sundance film of all. A musical about film critics at Sundance.
Well, there was actually a film about musicians in Brooklyn, and that was the most Sundancey film that I saw, but we can get to that later.
And the worst.
So, okay, what was I talking about? Oh, The One I Love. Okay, here we go. It's got Mark Duplass. It's got Elizabeth Moss, who had two very good movies at Sundance this year. And it is directed by a gentleman named, he's a first-time director. Thank you so much. Charlie McDowell, that's his name. And I don't want to say too much about the film because it's one of these movies that has kind of a little twisty narrative. But I will say, essentially, Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, play a struggling married couple. He cheated on her not too long ago, and they're trying to figure it out. Their marriage counselor is Ted Danson. And at the beginning of the film, Ted Danson recommends that they go to this cottage in the middle of nowhere to figure out, you know, rediscover their love and whatnot. And what happens after that is very fascinating. It was, I think, for most people at the festival, they didn't know much about the film. And it was definitely a surprise to see what ended up becoming of it. And very well reviewed. Mark Duplass is great. Elizabeth Moss is really great. And
it's just
really
great.
Yeah, she's very good. It's just really sharp writing, you know, and it really examines all the little things in a relationship that kind of almost grow as you get older with a person, and just how those small things end up being the things that kind of make or break your bond. And I think, you know, very funny, but also very insightful. I was really very, very pleasantly surprised by the film. So I think it got picked up.
Yep. Radius TWC is released at the end of the year.
Yeah, so you'd definitely be able to see it, and I really hope a lot of people see it. It's very impressive. So yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Next up, Obvious Child.
Oh my God, that's three in a row, Julian. You're right.
You're such an obvious child.
So that song is in the movie. The Paul Simon song is in the movie.
Sweet, I guess.
Okay, this movie is directed by Gillian Gillian Robosphere. I don't know, Gillian Gillian. Stars Jenny Slate, who's a comedian. I think she was on SNL for one season. You might know her as the voice of Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which is the internet, kind of the internet, famous internet animation. If you don't know it, look it up. It's hysterical.
And Parks and Rec.
Oh, thank you, Parks and Rec. And she's in Parks and Rec and that title show, House of Something.
House of Lies, maybe.
Yes, thank you. So anyway, she plays a New York comedian, New York stand-up comedian, who, you know, is a regular at this one kind of dive bar, you know, kind of getting a growing fan base, whatnot. Her best friend is Gabby Hoffman, who's having somewhat of a career comeback in the indie world right now. She's great. And essentially she, in the very beginning of the movie, loses her job, gets dumped, and then gets really, really drunk and has sex with this finance guy who lives in Manhattan, and then finds out that she is pregnant with his child. And in the whole film is essentially, you know, what is a late 20s, early 30s, you know, quote unquote artist do in this day and age when something like that happens. And it's very funny. I guess it all depends on how much you like Jenny Slate. But I will say, if you have any knowledge of her and any reason to like her, I think she more than proves herself in this film. I really do believe this film reveals her to be potentially the next great, you know, the next great film, you know, comedian leading lady. And so, the worry would be that it would be a hipster type of thing where it's a lot of it takes place in Brooklyn and maybe it'll be a little bit twee and whatnot, but it does not fall in any of those traps. It's a very honest look at what you would do in that situation. And I just really applaud the filmmaking. A24 picked it up, which is great, because, you know, they have kind of built a nice little track record for themselves so far. So I really hope they give this the proper theatrical release. And I really think this will be the beginning of a really nice career for her, Jenny Slate. So
a lot of people told me this was the film to see. And I tried to see it again towards the end, but I wasn't able to. But yeah, I hear really good things.
Would it make
this
a good double feature with Knocked Up?
It would. It definitely handles it a lot differently in terms of, I guess it is almost ostensibly very similar, but handles it a lot differently. But it would make a good double feature with that.
All right. Well, I'm interested to see what song we'll get for the next one. It is The Raid 2.
Hell yeah. finally a real movie we can talk about.
Oh, God.
Yeah, let's get over all this hipster shit and talk about The Raid 2.
Sundance, Schmundance.
Baron Dahl.
The Raid 2. See some people get bludgeoned to death.
I loved The Raid. I cannot wait for this.
Can I ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
I was going to ask.
What? No.
Why Why does the Raid 2 premiere at Sundance? Like, what is the reason? What's the thinking behind that?
Well,
it's a perfect palette.
The first one showed there.
The original one played at the midnight.
The original played.
I mean, it's just like every other Sundance movie. It's an alumni relationship, political considering the festival's lineup, this was like probably the most hyped film for a lot of people because
that's true.
It's the only movie people actually like knew anything about or were excited, you know.
I mean, they did need some bad movies to fill out the slate. They couldn't just have.
Don't even try, Jordan.
All right,
because you couldn't stomach it.
Jordan, wait, did you like the original Raid?
Yes, I like the original very much.
There are valid complaints to have with this film in terms of the length and the pacing and the sprawling aspect of it because it is basically taking the initial just. Not even concept, but just the players and the character and the style of that kind of action and amping it to like full volume to just take everything to the extreme. But in the process, they try and create a world that's a little more sprawling. So it doesn't have that same quick pacing as the original Raid.
I mean,
but
you could literally just add another building and the world would be more sprawling.
Instead, they opt for a more like trying to create like a Departed or if you've seen Infernal Affairs or even like a Hard Boiled, that kind of like big gangster setup where you have all these different forces in play so that by the time the climax of the film arrives, it's just a pure all out chaos of all these combined forces. But I also appreciated the film for giving a little bit of rhythm between having these scenes where they're genuinely trying to act, you know, as good as they can. And I'm not saying they're the greatest actors, but there's some genuine drama. And Gareth Evans, I think, is a real talent. I mean, just as the way he frames things, the way he paces things, the editing, the cinematography, it's all top notch. And of course, the fighting in this film is unlike anything I have ever seen. I mean, I loved this movie so much, I went and saw it again over seeing another movie just because I wanted to relive that excitement. And it held up on the second time seeing it within 24 hours. So you can call me a fanboy if you want, but I love The Raid 2. If you like the original Raid purely for the action portions, I think you're going to love The Raid 2. Even though it's a little bit more of a slow burn, I think it's more rewarding in the end. And yeah, I can't wait for Raid 3 whenever that comes out, which is definitely going to happen.
Well, that's great because I loved The Raid.
Yeah.
Like,
me too, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan, go ahead.
I won't rant.
No, you can. It's fair. Because there were some people that didn't like it, but...
I think there were three people out of the 3,000 that saw it at Sundance that didn't like it. No, no.
Really enthusiastic praise for this.
Speak your mind.
It was
go
insane.
Ahead.
This is a safe place.
We're all friends here.
No. For me, like Brian, I really liked the controlled aspect of the first film. Like, not I think it was 90 minutes, if that, and which is wall to wall action. The character stuff wasn't great, but it was, you know, it gave you what you needed to root for the good guys and not the bad guys, you know, that's all you need.
Sweet, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. It was a very simple, like, to its core movie. And this one, he took from another script that wasn't even supposed to be part of the Raid, and was like, oh, I can make this movie now because I have the clout, and he did, and you can tell.
But he had originally written this prior to the original Raid, and it was still the same, like, world. This was like it was basically like the Raid was his way of getting to make this movie.
All right,
you know?
Well, that's sad because I feel like he should stick with this.
So, think he needed to tighten it? If Raid 2 was 90 minutes, would you think you would have loved it? And it was just
because the last 30 minutes are really good, and there's probably two set pieces in between that I quite enjoyed.
It's gratuitous in how much they just, you know, and, just have action and everything.
But for me, that was not my problem. Wasn't the action? There was not like one of our friends walked out because he thought the action was too gross, and that did not. This honestly felt so detached from humanity, like it was a video game, that none of it really affected me on any level. For me, it was the dialogue in between. None of these characters you really give a shit about. A smidge about the main one, but that's about it. And there was there wasn't two sentences that were pieced together that gave any tension to me, like, at all throughout the movie. And so for about 20 minutes in, I knew I was in for, like, a dreadful time, and it just kept, kept going that direction until I would say, yeah, there's a car chase. And then after that, it's decent. There's a really that car chase and
I mean, definitely like the last thirty minutes is basically just nonstop action. But yeah.
And I hate the rest of those guys movies. That's like, oh, I you know, if all the action is good, then I'll like it. Yeah, that and really, you know me, Brian. That is not me. And
right.
And
but I will say I'm not trying to give this movie a fair pass for all the dialogue not being great, but I did think actually that I was invested in the characters and also just not maybe not all their relationships, but the layout of the land and how each one was trying to screw one over and all the it's very like gangster style typical stuff. But I was into it from the get go, and even though it's long, it didn't feel that long to me.
I will say I can understand anyone who, I mean, like just going off the violence in the last movie, like that movie had some of the most realistic stabbing that I've ever seen in a film. So I can get behind people who might have an issue.
I mean,
with
the violence in this movie is almost to a cartoonish level, but it's still all done in that style, which is kind of real and visceral and just unnerving to watch, but also exciting. And I think if you're a fan of just the style of the first one, it's just more of that. Just spread out and more bigger, you know.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
No, I will definitely be alone. I have found solace in that. It is okay.
It's
everyone,
okay, Jordan, we just need to see it again, Jordan.
No,
I'll point out the good parts for you.
Jordan, this is your Francis Ha.
It is on the opposite level. Yes,
because I hated that, and I'm like, I still can't find anyone to agree with me on that.
Yeah. So anyways, this comes out March 28th. Everyone, go enjoy it. And I'll probably see it for the third time
when it comes out.
So. Oh, Brad.
Yes.
All right. Well, the final one is the Voices.
Yeah, one we can all agree on.
We can all agree on
this
one.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna just start quickly. I saw a tweet that said they're gonna need to invent a new cinema score for this movie in terms of lower than an F, because this will not go over well with general audiences in the least.
It's one of the darkest
but most entertaining and hilarious comedies, but also just one, yeah. Anyway, so this is from Margene Satrapi, I think is how you pronounce it.
Satrapi,
yeah. So she co-directed Persepolis, which is the black and white animation that was nominated for an Oscar at least like 6 years ago, and then she made a really great movie called Chicken with Plums that just got shafted by Sony Pictures Classics 2 years ago, and now she's back with her biggest effort yet, and this is actually written by a Paranormal Activity 2 writer. So he pulled out all this stuff. Yeah, this is on the blacklist too. I think it was number 3 of its respective year. And anyway, so this stars Ryan Reynolds as a bathtub manufacturer, like factory worker, and he lives at home with his two pets, a dog and a cat, and they both talk to him. And it's not like the Disney movie that might suggest.
No, even though it's that same kind of special effect, it's much darker.
The first probably, I would say, 20 to 25 minutes kind of has that. Like, but something's also very off and uneasy in terms of Ryan Reynolds' performance. Like he, this is, I think, his best performance.
I would agree. I mean, I was blown away by how good he was in this, and the way he straddles that line of just like being like neurotic and then just going slightly over the edge. It's really good.
This could have been like one of the biggest disasters I've ever seen if the director and the main actor did not kind of carefully told this line. Because I guess it's not a spoiler to say like he has a mental illness and
And isn't it true that he does the voices of the dog and the cat, which also like I think
are you guys sure about that? Because I thought it was revealed.
No, he did. She said in an interview that he did.
He did do the voices.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, wow.
And so I think that adds another level. Because watching it, you can almost not even tell that it doesn't sound anything like him, either voice. And
yeah. I didn't even think about it. I did not notice that at all.
The first 20 minutes, you kind of know he has this like instant attraction to one of his coworkers in accounting, played by Gemma Arterton.
Oh, well, that's understandable.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
And I don't want to say what happens like after that, but I will say like Dan was like clutching his putting his hands over his eyes like for half the movie, and I was like laughing my ass off, so that can kind of give you like,
I was laughing heartily, and it's great in a very dark kind of thing. It's almost like a John Waters like serial mom, like kind of like dark.
Yeah, Yeah. A lot like that, yeah. Like that's very.
Thing that happened 1 second, and then another second, you're just laughing your ass off. And just the way that they balance that is just brilliant. And this movie still hasn't got picked up, which is not surprising. But when it does, really seek this out. I think this is just like the making of like a cult classic.
Yeah, it was really good. I would watch it again for sure.
Yeah, keyword there being cults.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm looking forward to that coming out hopefully soon. So let's just do some rapid fire. Talk about some stuff that we didn't talk about before. Anyone can feel free to start.
Yeah. No, I'll just highlight a few titles that were kind of major going in and my thoughts on them. So first up is Anton Corbijn's A Most Wanted Man, which was probably one of my most anticipated. And if you've seen The American Control, this film is not really in that style. It's more of like a shot like a Homeland episode, which is really disappointing. So, it is interesting. It's a John Le Carre adaptation, and so just like the whole plot hinges on like the most minute things, so that's kind of interesting. It just takes place in Hamburg, and Philip Seymour Hoffman leads like a intelligence gathering initiative, and it's very slow burn, but still worth seeing. But not the knockout that I was expecting. So
I heard it's slow.
It's slow, but I was engaged the whole time, but it's just slow. Anyways, and then the other one was Frank, which is this film by Lenny Abramson, who did What Richard Did, which not many people saw, but it's was led by Jack Rayner, who is now the lead in the next Transformers. So that's how he got this movie, because he gave a great performance in that film. And so anyways, this is his biggest movie yet, with Michael Fassbender, although you don't really see his face for almost the entire movie. And it's just about the creative process. Michael Fassbender plays a lead in a band, and a newcomer in the band is played by Domhnall Gleeson, who led About Time.
He was in a Byzantium, too, with Jim Martin.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, no, he wasn't. Nope,
no?
I lied.
All right, you liar.
I can't help it. I'm just not good at this. I thought I could make it up.
And so this is a very, like, odd, off-kilter film. It's full of, like, original moments. And it's just about kind of the creative process, and then there's kind of a little not twist, but just a reveal at the end, which I think like makes it goes from just a fine movie to a really, really solid one. It's a kind of unforgettable ending. And so I would definitely recommend seeking this out. Magnolia Films bought it, or Magnolia Pictures, and
Do they have a release date yet? No, not yet.
It's just kind of early. I would guess by the end of the year.
And Domhnall Gleeson was in Anna Karenina and Dread, two films that I enjoyed very much, so I am looking forward to that.
And then really quickly, another one, The Skeleton Twins, which was really buzzed about. And it's Bill Hader and
Kristen
Wiig, SNL alums. And it's probably their best performance, I would say, just because this is not really a broad comedy. It opens with both of them trying to commit suicide on opposite ends of the country, and that reunites them when one of them fails. And they both fail, but one of them is interrupted by the other's failure. And it's a solid movie, just about siblings and connecting and kind of stuff like that. And so it's not. I would say the script is a little too Sundancey in terms of being very tidy and wrapping things up when the subject matter doesn't really match that. It would be better if it was kind of like a more off the wall approach, I would think. But anyways, it's solid and it's coming out. And then lastly, segueing to Raffi's choice, we both saw this movie, White Bird in a Blizzard, which is Greg Araki's latest movie. And this is kind of a coming of age tale mixed with like a kind of like a murder mystery or disappearance mystery, I guess you could say.
An early David Lynch kind of feeling to it.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah. Shailene Woodley.
Shailene Woodley was amazing in it, and I was kind
of. Yeah, she's really, really good. And so the movie it opens with in 1988, and her mom, played by Ava Green, disappears, and the movie is kind of her dealing with that through this therapy session with Angela Bassett is a therapist, and so she kind of reflects on when her mom was there and the reasons for her disappearance, and match that with her actual like coming of age and her life. And the Ava Green section didn't really interest me as much as just Shailene Woodley's coming of age and kind of.
I thought Ava Green was great though.
She was, yeah. That section was good, but even the way Araki focuses that on in the end, kind of it kind of has a very silly ending. Like
yeah, the ending's a little silly.
Like kind of a gotcha ending, whereas the actual emotional through line is more Shailene Woodley and yeah, one of her most mature performances yet. And it's not just because she's naked. So
I thought it was one of these. Yes, I thought. I thought it was one of these movies that were a coming of age that wasn't overbearing with a lot of the coming of age typical stuff you see.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
And that hasn't got picked up, and I don't think it would get a wide audience. So if you look on that for VOD, I would assume whenever it gets picked up.
Yeah. Sweet. And then, my rapid fire real quick. Dear White People, which was Justin Simien's debut feature about a college that throws a party which causes a stir between the different communities in the school. And it's basically a really smart satire about race and like postmodern times and how there's a certain appropriation of culture happening. And I think the film's strength is Justin Simien's voice as a filmmaker. It kind of reminded me of like how Kevin Smith shines through in Clerks. Like you really get a sense of who Kevin Smith is through that film. And this film feels a lot in that way that a lot of the characters just feel like voices for his what he's trying to say with the film. Some of the characters end up feeling like caricatures, but overall it has some funny moments and some interesting things to think about. But I think he's one to look out for, and I believe that got picked up, and I think is gonna, or maybe not, but
No, I don't think so.
I'm sure someone's gonna pick that up because I feel like it has a lot of marketable approach. Then I saw Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, which is from the Zellner brothers who did Kid Thing. I don't know if any of you guys saw that, which was at Sundance last year. And I wasn't a huge fan of that, and I'm not a huge fan of this film, even though some people have really given this film some high praise. This film stars the actress.
Miko Kikuchi.
Yes, she was in Pacific Rim, and she gives a great performance as kind of this mentally ill woman in Japan who's obsessed with the movie Fargo. And in particular, the scene where Steve Buscemi buries the money and she wants to like go and to America and find that specific location. And it's one of these movies that's very, it's purely like framed for their style to like express themselves as filmmakers. And there's not a lot of in-depth into her character. Her character is almost like an artifice for the film. It's just like she's passing through doing this thing when it's actually based on like a true story. So they really avoid like going into like the intricacies of what might make her do this and just like use her more as a prop for the way they like to shoot. So I felt it was a lot more style over any kind of substance. And ultimately I thought the movie was kind of boring, but it has a kind of cool cinematography, and the score won an award at Sundance, which by the Octopus Project, which the score was cool, but at times it's a little dissonant and a little distorted. And I found it a little irritating, even though I typically like that kind of electronic type of score. And so, yeah, that was that. So it was kind of a miss for me, but some people enjoyed it. So I would say if you like the Kid Thing, or if you're a fan of the Zellner brothers, you might be interested in checking it out, but otherwise I'd pass. And then lastly, a film that got a lot of positive buzz, I feel, a lot of positive critiques. So I may be in the minority here, but it's the follow-up to Another Earth, Greg Cahill's, Mike Cahill?
Mike Cahill.
This is I, Origins, which starred Britt Marling, Michael Pitt, and a really fantastic performance from the newcomer, and I'm blanking on her name, but she's definitely the best part of the movie. It's another one of these kind of true science, romantic melodrama that's like a little overindulgent in its own concept, and personally, I found it really cheesy and corny. I like to say I eye-rolled, my eyes roll, I mean, because it's all about eyes.
That's awful.
Yeah, Michael Pitt is supposed to be like this molecular biologist, and it's like there's no way I'm believing him for one second as a molecular biologist. He looks stoned in every second of that film. And Britt Marling just, to me, lacks any kind of real emotion, and I mean, at least in this film, and she felt like almost like a dead weight to the film. And the film is just really into its own like out there concepts, and it just felt overly pretentious, you know, tedious to watch, and I really did not like this at all. And yeah, that's my quick fire.
Okay,
Daniel.
Yes. All right, let's do this. Number one, Wish I Was Here, the Zach Braff movie that was very kind of anticipated, you know, because of the Kickstarter way he funded the film, and also because he did Garden State, which was a big hit at Sundance 10 years ago. Saw this one. It's a mess. He wrote, directed it, starred in it. Long and short of it, he plays a struggling, out-of-worked actor who can't support his family. His father, played by Mandy Patinkin, gets sick, and he has to make some tough choices. Unfortunately, Zach Braff's character is insanely unlikable and doesn't really have enough of a character arc to ever make us care too much about him. So that's tough. There are some good ideas here, of course. Braff is a good writer. He has some very good ideas, but they just never gel. There are a lot of ridiculous subplots that make no sense. Definitely a miss. I will say the one highlight is Kate Hudson, who's playing Braff's wife and is doing very good work here. Let's all pray she continues to do things like this, because she really is a talented actress. She's kind of wasted a decade doing rom-coms. So that's the one silver lining. And then what's the other one, Jordan, that I'm talking about? It is Song a film one. Called Song One. And if we're talking about bad movies, we can talk about Song One. It is a film starring Anne Hathaway. And it is takes place in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where I live, actually. And it's about musicians. I guess the story is she's an anthropologist who comes home because her brother, who's an aspiring musician, is hit by a cab and is in a coma. And she comes home to obviously be with her family. Her mother's played by a very wasted Mary Steenburgen. And essentially she discovers who her little brother's favorite musician was. His name is James Forrester, and ends up falling in love with said musician. It's very contrived, very impressed with itself. The music comes from Jenny Lewis, and I believe John Rice. And the music is good. The music is definitely the highlight. If you like indie rock, if you like that whole world, it definitely gets that right. Unfortunately, the dialogue's stilted. The performances are very, very bad. And there's just not much to keep the story grounded. And so it just becomes very melodramatic for no reason. So I would say 100% skip it, and you could buy that soundtrack. And then the final film was Camp X-Ray, Jordan. And this is the Kristen Stewart movie where she plays a soldier in Guantanamo Bay who, like, develops a relationship, or develops a, you know, not a physical relationship, but a friendship, if you will, with a detainee. Oh, and you know what I got to say? It's an easy movie to go into.
Ready. Twilight 4, Guantanamo Bay.
It's an easy movie to go into. Prepared to not like, but I really, I mean, I don't know. I feel I'm sometimes a Kristen Stewart defender or whatever, but I think she does really good work here. It's nice to see her really challenge herself. And so that in itself is
nice. I feel
like
making a peanut butter sandwich would challenge her.
Burn.
And I like these two movies she's in. So
what's your Angela Land and something else?
I actually enjoyed Snow White and the Huntsman.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
You know what? I don't know who just said no, but you're on my list now.
But, I mean, you know, I guess the problem is this movie is very overwritten, unfortunately, and so the messages end up becoming, you know, too clear, too shoved down your throat.
I hear, but the last 20 minutes especially.
Yeah, the last 15 minutes are like almost a shame, because if it ended, I mean, maybe it's a fix. If it ends 15 minutes before, I like a lot more. So, you know, maybe there's something, whoever picks it up can fix it. But, and then I cannot remember for the life of me the gentleman from A Separation, but he plays the detainee. And he is, I think it's Payman Mossadi, I believe.
I hear he's great.
And he is so good in this movie. So, so good. So, I mean, if no other reason, the two lead performances are very impressive. And then there was one more, Jordan, I was going to quickly bring up, right?
Well, if you wanted to talk about Trip to Italy, which is fine.
The Trip to Italy is which is the Steve Coogan, Rob Bray.
More food and Michael Caine jokes, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. More food, more Michael Caine, a little bit of heart. If you like the first one, you'll really like the second one. It'll definitely be available if it's not
available. You're a land ho, Dan.
You are. You're a hole of land. But yeah, I mean, definitely a solid B. And if you like British comedy, you will like The Trip to Italy.
Cheerio.
And as a note, we did not to our best. We tried really hard, but we did not see Whiplash, which won all the awards.
I was about to say, did no one see Whiplash?
Yeah, well,
we tried.
Literally, this is the only time I've ever seen this happen. The entire, not a single person got in from the wait list. I went at a midnight screening, and not a single, the theater was 100% full. I've never seen it happen at all Sundance. So, oh well. But it's supposed to be good, so...
All right. Yeah. Well, keep that one in your back pocket, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, but you can read all the, I think, over 40 published reviews from the fest. So, yeah, there's some still notable ones. So read them on the film stage.
Raid 2.
Yeah, Raid 2. So if anyone wants to see more of what we thought of the fest, go to thefilmstage.com and click around. I'm sure you'll find it. Let's talk about quickly what's coming out to theaters and DVD and Blu-ray. Coming to Blu-ray, we have Rush, which Danny King talked about on this podcast not too long ago. Bad Grandpa. I'm sorry. Let me to correct myself. Academy Award nominated Bad Grandpa.
Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. Please. Thank you.
Academy Award nominated Jackass Presents Bad Grandpa. Whew. We also have Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. Las Vegas.
I've seen all of these, sadly.
Jesus.
As have I.
The Fifth Estate. Did anyone see that?
Yeah.
No, dude. You saw The Fifth Estate?
Yeah, I did.
What?
I have my one-word reviews from all of them.
For the longest time, I believed that I dreamed The Fifth Estate. Not even that I saw it, just the idea of it.
I love when that happens with movies.
Yeah, it's like, oh, shit, that was a real thing. Oh, even better, though, is when you're like, wait, that didn't come out already?
Yeah.
We have Metallica's Through the Never. And, hey, I'm going to give a shout-out to the full series of Treme, because that's a goddamn awesome television show.
Oh, wait, you mean Trem?
Yeah, Treme.
Okay.
Yeah, also, Dan, have you seen the Terrence Davies movies, The Long Day Closes, that comes out on Criterion?
I did not.
All right.
Yes, the Terrence Davies film. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a great movie.
Yeah.
So, Jordan, you saw all those. Was any of them worth it?
I wasn't a big fan of Rush, but a lot of people like it.
Oh no, dude, I really liked Rush.
It doesn't have a single Academy Award nomination, does it?
Whatever.
I wasn't a fan, but go for it. And then Bad Grandpa is fine. It's a little better than what you think, but not that great. And then Glad of the Chance of Meatballs 2 is a massive letdown from the first one, so don't do that. And then Las Vegas has its moments, surprisingly, but not great. Not a great movie.
No, definitely Las Vegas is not.
And by has its moments, I mean it has like two moments.
Yes.
No. Las Vegas, the way this is what you say. How much do you like Kevin Kline? That's Las Vegas.
That's true.
How much do you like Kevin Kline? Kevin Kline is the reason why.
Not enough for Las Vegas.
Not enough for me. Clearly, it is enough for Las Vegas because I watched it. But other than that, you know, that's it.
Right. The State is just a misfire. It's just I don't know why they made it. There's nothing about it that seems like you're getting anything new from the story. Even the performances feel so like calculated that it just doesn't feel. Two Daniel Brühl movies that aren't that good coming out. Wow. Definitely see Rush over Fifth Estate, though. I'll say that.
All right. And then opening in theaters this weekend, we have two comedies, I think. I don't know.
I wouldn't call Labor Day a comedy.
All right. So coming to theaters this week, we have two films. The first is Labor Day, directed by Jason Reitman, which is it's weird that this isn't getting more fanfare, but I guess apparently it was just kind of okay instead of great.
Yeah, so. You guys talked about this last week, and I think it's supposedly Jason Reitman is like off already shooting his other movie, so he's like, I'm not going to do any press for this, plus the reviews aren't that great, even though we freaking loved it. Jeremy Barak, you can yell at him if you hate it.
Okay.
And
then we also have That Awkward Moment, starring Zac Efron, Michael B. Jordan, and Miles Teller.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I thought it was starring us. But.
Nice.
Well stated. Those are coming out.
Go see your top choices for new movies this week are Tim's Vermeer, which won't be very a lot of theaters, but it's a documentary that's highly praised by Penn and Teller. And then on VOD is Grand Piano, which is supposed to be like a Hitchcock / Brian De Palma-esque thriller with Elijah Wood. That comes out Friday on VOD, so it's highly recommended from what I've heard. So.
All right, and for all the normal people out there, Ride Along was number one in the theaters this week again. I'm still looking forward to seeing that.
What do you mean by normal people?
What I mean, like, you talked about a documentary and then a VOD.
VOD is accessible.
Okay, all right.
That is the people. It's
the, yeah. The VOD.
More people have access to that than Ride Along than to go to the theater.
Wait, what's Ride Along?
Wait, you don't know what Ride Along is?
I don't think so.
Ice Cube is a cop, it's and Kevin Hart wants to marry his sister. So he takes him on a ride along.
I need to see this.
Guy, oh my God. It's like the trailer's actually flat out hilarious.
All right.
But I need to
but
go
Brian, you know, Brian, you don't mean that, Brian.
What do you mean I don't mean that?
I don't know. I just watched the Kevin Hart special on Netflix and I was not impressed.
Sure, Brian, I got to take you on a ride along.
It only has 17% Rotten Tomatoes if that was going to quell any of your fears. So.
And yet, it's already grossed $75 million.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's just Ride Along, baby. That's just Ride Along.
The sequel was put into the film at least like 5 months before this came out. So.
Is there actually a sequel?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wait, what is the sequel titled?
It's called Ride Along. Ride along to ride longer.
All right. Well, anyway, no need to do random selections because we just threw so many movie titles at you that they'd probably all get lost anyway.
We watched Sundance movies the last week, so we have nothing else for you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it. That's all. Thank you again for joining us. Hopefully, this has given you a slew of new movies to look forward to this year. Let's tell the people where we can be found. I'm just going to come out and say it. We can all be found on the film stage. And if you would like to read any in-depth reviews of any of the movies we talked about and see all the other movies that we didn't have time for, go to the film stage and find our Sundance coverage. In the meantime, gentlemen, where can you be found online? Let's start with Dan.
Hey, what's up? I can be found at DJ Mecca. That's my Twitter, at DJ Mecca. And then thefilmstage.com.
Constantly disappointed that you're not an actual DJ.
I know, I'm working on it.
He's trying.
Okay.
DJ Raffy, on the other hand.
Raffy, no, who Jay is a Raffy. DJ and does not have DJ in his Twitter handle.
Yes, you can find...
Wait, Dan, do you have people following you because they believe you are a DJ?
Dan doesn't have many people following him.
I'm not going to say yes, I'm not going to say no, you know what I mean?
I would love to ask that you just got a question about DJ techniques.
Hey man, sure. I'm looking to buy a table. What would you recommend? I don't know. Like, I guess oak or mahogany is pretty good.
Oak or mahogany.
All right, Raffy.
Yes, Raffy. You can find me on Twitter at Zaffy, Z-A-F-F-I. That's also my Instagram handle because I love to do that, and Vine. And, of course, you can find all my reviews on the Film Stage, the best site for movie and reviews and info and all that stuff. So come check us out.
Do it.
Sweet. And Jordan.
JP Ralph on the Twitters and the Film Stage.
And you can find me on the Twitters at Brian J. Rowan, and you can find me also at my personal site, dearfilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. We just don't know what we're talking about yet.